Okay, good morning, everyone. So I'm going to be talking about prescriber identifiable prescription tracking, and I'll get to it to define exactly what that is. By way of disclosure, this actually considered a true conflict because the Attorney General's office doesn't sell goods or services. But I did want to mention it, among other reasons, just because that's sort of where this story begins with my work working for the Vermont Attorney General's office. And specifically on some litigation to do with where pharmaceutical industry and the health information organizations are trying to stop legislation that's trying to sort of shed some sunshine into the different areas of pharmaceutical marketing to doctors. Specifically, they're making the claim that there's no evidence that prescription tracking is harmful. So I was interested to confirm this. So I performed a multidisciplinary review of literature, looking not just at public health and medicine, but also economics, marketing, and business. To get a sense of scale and proportion, in the United States in 2006, there was over $200 billion in prescription drugs sold. That's forecasted to grow at a rate of about 8% per year through 2015, so it's just this huge sum of money. And then there's about $20 billion a year spent marketing to doctors, and that's important to mention because this ultimately becomes a story about marketing. And in terms of what marketing to a doctor looks like, it can look like pretty much any one of those bullet points up there. A couple are highlighted: product sampling, which is of course giving doctors free samples to give to their patients, and then a practice of detailing where a pharmaceutical sales rep actually goes and visits with a doctor and gives them information and, you know, pens and coffee mugs and whatnot. Those are important because those are sort of the ways that prescription tracking leverages changes in prescribing habits. And then the last point is also worth noticing because we're not just talking about, you know, pens and information. In the state of Vermont, which is one of the few states to actually track cash payments that the pharmaceutical industry gives to physicians, they found that of psychiatrists who received money from the pharmaceutical industry in 2007, the average payment was $57,000. So these are not insignificant sums of money. So getting back to prescription tracking and what it is, essentially it's a detailed report, or it produces a detailed report of every prescription that is written by a specific prescriber. The prescriber's name is, of course, identified, Dr. Smith or whatever. The patients are de-identified, but they are identified in terms of, you know, a female of XYZ age and what their condition is. And these reports show what kind of drugs are being prescribed for which conditions and what the dosages are. And as you can imagine, this is something that's it's a relatively new practice, and it's really been enabled by information technology. You just wouldn't be able to do this without sort of robust electronic infrastructure to process all the, you can imagine all those little prescriptions that go out to pharmacies or what have you all over a state or a country. To sort of analyze that, you really do need a robust information technology system. The data flow, where it comes from and where it goes, it's gathered at pharmacies at the point of sale. The data itself is then sold to health information organizations, and three of the largest ones in the world actually are listed there: IMS Health, Verispan, and Wolters Kluwer. They compile and analyze these reports, sell them to pharmaceutical marketers, who then use it for marketing, for more efficient detailing and sampling efforts, which increase sales, but also build and maintain brand loyalty. That, in turn, of course, creates more prescriptions, and the cycle goes on. And in terms of who benefits and how this process leverages its desired results, this graph here sort of shows the financial and information exchange cycle for this data. And obviously, initially, data comes from the patient as to what they're in a clinical exam as to what prescription they need. A prescriber then creates the prescription. It ultimately goes to a pharmacy. The dotted lines here represent financial payments, and then the solid lines represent data. You can see the pharmacies then sell the information to the HIOs, who then sell it again after it's analyzed to the pharmaceutical industry. That information then makes its way back to the prescriber itself in the form of marketing and in all its various forms, including social engineering and cash payments in some cases. that will then make create changes in the in prescribing practices and increase the prescribing of certain targeted drugs, which again feeds the cycle and creates more profit, et cetera, for the pharmaceutical industry. And it's worth noticing that in this cycle, the patient is sort of patient care is largely irrelevant, and that the patients receive no apparent benefit from this type of marketing. It's something that's purely driven by these four players here. Other uses alleged by industry are that the data can be used for academic research, or obviously if you know specifically what doctors are prescribing what drugs, if a new risk factor emerges, perhaps we could use that to send safety letters. The problem with this is that there's anecdotal evidence that the data is A, either too costly for academic researchers. These reports are just incredibly expensive. And also that some HIOs have not been willing to release data to certain academic researchers when they find out that academic researchers are trying to look into this practice, because it's not for basically that this data is really for marketing. It's not really for academic researchers, and they don't really want academic researchers who sort of have an obligation to open methods, et cetera, to shed too much light on what's going on. In terms of the safety letters to prescribers, in this country, the FDA already has a process for letting prescribers know about new risk factors, and there's really no evidence that this information would be used or has been used for this purpose. Earlier, if for those of you who heard the presidential address, Linda DeGutis was talking about one of the themes of this meeting being cross-cultural challenges. And when you look for evidence of harm from this practice of prescription tracking, you sort of encounter a different type of cross-cultural conflict. And this slide, which is a little bit too busy to actually probably make out, but it really shows a different form of cross-cultural conflict, and that there's really no direct scientific evidence that prescription tracking leads to any kind of harm for two primary reasons. One is that it's a new practice and the science just hasn't caught up with industry yet. And also the entire practice is somewhat shrouded in secrecy, and this is really to do with you know, our public health values really looked to open methods, reproducibility, the scientific peer review process is the standard for decision making. Our goal is to improve public health, and so we search for reliable scientific evidence. On the industry side, it's not that they're bad and we're good, it's just they have a different set of values. They're really allowed, in many cases encouraged, to maintain secrecy. You have trade secret laws and antitrust laws that in some cases force them to not share information. It's also considered prudent business practice to not share your information with your competitors. And their real standard for decision-making is legal review. It's not, in other words, will this practice be legally defensible in court? And so they use legal strategies to keep the process alive. It's not so much looking for good, reliable scientific evidence. Because ultimately, they're motivated to do what businesses do, which is create value and make profit. So since there's no real direct evidence, you have to find a different way, obviously, to see if any harm is being done. And so the way that I chose was to assess the impact. We know that prescription tracking is used for detailing and sampling, so we can look to see what detailing and sampling does. And there's lots of evidence out there showing that detailing leads to an increased prescription in the writing of prescriptions for the detailed drug. It leads to more prescriptions for newer drugs generally. It also leads to increase in irrational prescribing. And irrational prescribing is when you choose a newer, more expensive drug that has no therapeutic benefits over an older, less expensive drug. Obviously, the fact that it's a newer drug means it's riskier just because we don't know much about it yet. So there could be unknown risks. It also leads to increase in requests for these drugs to be added to formularies, so physicians get used to using them and they want to keep being able to use them. And it leads to anywhere from a 30 to 60% reduction in the prescribing of lower-cost generics. The relationship for all four of the arrows going up is positive, statistically significant, but it wanes over time. So you can't just detail once. You got to keep going back to the doctor over time to build that relationship. But it's not very efficient. Industry data shows that anywhere between less than 1 to 6.5 visits by a detailer are necessary to get one additional prescription out of a physician. But ultimately, it is very profitable. This is a slide shows information on return on investment for detailing. And it shows overall, if you look at all drugs that are detailed, for every dollar spent in detailing, industry earns back somewhere between $1.25 and $1.70 in sales. And then for larger, like blockbuster brands, and you can see some of them up there, the return is huge. You know, upwards of 1,000% in some case. In other words, $1 in gets you up $10 or $12 back. Now, looking at sampling, which is of course when a doctor has free samples that they give to their patients. Obviously, doctors are motivated to give out samples to help patients, especially poor or the uninsured. But in general, the sample drugs, they tend to be for more expensive, the more newer, more expensive drugs, and for chronic conditions, which leads to a couple of problems. One is that it's not the most effective drug, it's just the newest one. And also, if it's for a drug for a chronic condition, once the physician writes a subsequent prescription for a refill, it's actually going to lead to greater cost, despite that sort of that first freebie that the patient was able to get. There's also evidence that in the United States, poor and uninsured are receive free samples less often than wealthier and insured folks. And patients who receive samples actually end up paying more out of pocket, not less. And again, industry data shows that this practice is not that effective either. It takes anywhere between 6 and 73 samples to leverage one additional prescription. Other data, when you they've done studies comparing similar clinics, in other words, clinics that have pretty much see the same patients and same socio-demographics. Those clinics that give out free samples have higher 30-day prescribing costs and, of course, are more likely to write prescriptions for those sampled drugs. In pharmaceutical data that is available to us, there's a lot that's not, but what we do see shows a positive relationship between sampling and subsequent prescriptions for those sampled drugs. And looks like my graphic cut off some of this, that last bullet point, but one thing that does have consequences for the quality of care is that doctors who give out free samples are more likely to prescribe drugs that are not their preferred choice. They're not prescribing this drug because it's what they prefer, it's just because it's free and it's available. In terms of what's being done about it, some of the policy solutions and actions being taken, there has been legislation in several states that are trying to limit the commercial use of prescription tracking data. Unfortunately, there's three states, New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. They all passed legislation, and it's all either been thrown out in court or is currently being challenged by the health information organization industry. The American Medical Association has an opt-out provision where doctors can choose to sign up to not have their information shared. A couple of problems with that is it's not widely used. Only about 2% of physicians use it. And it actually doesn't block the data from marketers. It just blocks it from certain marketers, as in the person who walks in your door can't look at the information, but his or her superiors can look at the information and decide where to send that marketer. So it's not that helpful. Many states have done academic detailing, where they send out public health nurses, for example, with information on actual cost-effective medications. And the state of Vermont, as Maggie mentioned, just started a program where they're sending those academic detailers out with generic samples, so they can leave not the actual drug, but a coupon, so that they can sort of it has a psychological benefit when you can actually give the doctor something. Here, give this to your patient. So that's something new. There are also lots of anti-detailing policies at academic medical centers, but that doesn't necessarily help community-based physicians who may not have those policies. So to summarize, there is evidence that prescription tracking may be harmful. It's not direct scientific evidence, but it seems reasonable to assume, based on the data we have on detailing and sampling. Is it enough to reach a scientific threshold? Probably not. Is it enough to reach the legal threshold used by industry? I can't say because I'm not a lawyer, but it's probably worth thinking about. So the purpose of prescription tracking is to steer prescription decisions and to increase prescription spending, and it does appear to be achieving its purpose. And then some secondary points, just about sort of more generally, in terms of, particularly in cases like this where science hasn't caught up with industry, it becomes important to find alternate approaches to finding evidence, which is not to say that you go out and lower your standards, but just look, for example, beyond public health and medical research. A lot of this information about pharmaceutical marketing is actually in the marketing and business and economics literature, for example. And it's scientifically very valid stuff, but it's just not where public health folks often look. Public health also needs to consider the implications of information technology. There are lots of other dangers that, or potential dangers that lurk out there with information technology, much of it having to do with international issues as well, which I won't get into now. And also public health needs to understand the motivations and methods of private industry to understand and counter the possible harms that could be associated with business practices. For example, marketing in all commercial forms represents a potential threat to rational pharmaceutical use. And there's lots of other industries where, or instances where industry is not necessarily doing anything bad. It's just acting in the way that business does, without being aware of the public health impact. And so, from a public health perspective, you sort of need to be aware of that. Thank you.
I'd like to comment on that one a little bit more myself, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But let's move on to the next speaker, Laura Torino. I think I'll get back to the... is a family practice physician assistant who studied anthropology at State University of New York, at Potsdam and Temple University, and health sciences at the George Washington University.